People can take their seats. We're about to begin. Okay. Good morning. Welcome to the fifth international conference of the Schiller Institute. This is the fifth of a series of international conferences to invoke a new paradigm for mankind. The first was in Frankfurt following the November election. The second and third were in New York City and Washington, D.C. The fourth again in Germany near Frankfurt. And now the fifth in San Francisco. So welcome. Thank you all for coming. We are at a significant moment in world history. It's a deciding point for mankind. And the nature of the discussion for these conferences, which was inspired by Mrs. Helga Zepp-LaRouche, in the wake of what we saw as a very disturbing presidential election in November, but also provoked by a fight over 40 years that she and her husband and their collaborators have initiated, which is a new economic system globally for mankind, and perhaps for the first time consolidating a truly human culture and renaissance for the world. And it's now time to have a discussion with minds throughout the world, including California, the West Coast, and all parts of the world, and all continents, a sense of how are we going to establish this new economic system now, this renaissance for mankind now. And it's clear that it is a deciding moment, because we face, on the one hand, explicit calls for authoritarian regimes, for a 1930s approach towards the current economic crisis, and they don't mean Franklin Roosevelt. They are calling for fascism, whether it be J.P. Morgan Chase, or J.P. Morgan of London, the Bank of International Settlements, the Financial Times, the European financial ministers. They are calling for the bail-ins, for an explicit fascist police state measures to control the economic crisis. That's their alternative. That's their new economic system. Or we have this one, the one you're going to see presented today, the one you're going to participate in discussions from today and onward to implement a truly human condition for mankind globally. So that's the nature of the discussion today. I ask everyone to participate. Please bring questions. Bring the challenges you're facing in bringing these ideas to the population. And let's have a wonderful and optimistic sense of what we can do in a new Glass-Steagall paradigm. So on that note, let me introduce the first keynote address of today's conference. She is a political warrior for the last 40 years in a fight to establish a new economic system. And she is the founder of the Schiller Institute and the initiator of these conferences. So let me introduce today Mrs. Helga Zepp-LaRouche.
Well, thank you for this introduction, and thank you for the welcome. I think we all are aware of the fact that we right now are finding ourselves in the middle of a world drama, which is so gigantic that if Shakespeare or Schiller would be here today, even them would be challenged to put something on stage bigger than the present world historical moment. Because if you look at the world situation in the totality of what is going on, it is mind-boggling. We are on the verge of a blowout of the financial system, which if it happens, which could happen any moment, would make look all previous financial crises look like peanuts, and that includes the Great Depression of the 30s. The financial system could evaporate overnight, like one of the CEOs of a large consulting firm has called like a supernova, that is when a star comes to its end and goes up in a huge light and energy. The financial oligarchy, which is in control of this present financial system, plans to establish nothing less than a world dictatorship. They are clearly intending to eliminate all leftovers of national sovereignty. In Europe, they have succeeded already very far, and in the United States, the Constitution is almost gone, if not reversed. They want to eliminate, and have already done so pretty much, all accomplishments of international law of the people. They want to return to a feudal order which is based on a population density which goes with a feudal order, and that means a severe reduction of the world population. Who knows, from 7 to 1 or no people at all. They risk the existence of civilization by playing around with a thermonuclear war. And they're pushing regime change policies against every country on the globe which is not agreeing to submit to this world order. So therefore, we are looking at a policy which at best would throw civilization into a new dark age and bring about misery for generations to come. And at worst, we are looking at the complete extinction of civilization, wiping out all the works and creative contributions of all our forebears, and even the memory of it would be eliminated. On the other side, we have the potential for ending oligarchism forever and do the promise or fulfill the promise of the great American president John Quincy Adams of forming an alliance of perfectly sovereign nation states on the globe. We could create a peace process among these nations through development, eliminating poverty and misery of billions of people who are suffering from it now for good, and that could be done in a very short period of time. We consciously could initiate the next era of history in human civilization, which could be so dramatically different that, like it was with the Middle Ages, and the new era, which was initiated by the great mind Nicolaus of Cusa, who laid the foundation for modern times. So we could initiate a new era of mankind, which would leave behind this unworthy oligarchical system and put the identity of mankind on the true nature of man, that is creativity, of creating a mankind where people are grown up, they would be united through the common aims of mankind and stop being greedy for foolish virtual money, which soon will evaporate anyway. Now, to contribute to the second version, to the better outcome of the present history, we have initiated these Schiller Institute conferences and naturally a fight around the world. But it is very clear that whatever we do in Europe or in other parts of the world, the decision which way this present historical branching point will go lies with the United States. Because it is the United States which has the power. It's a huge country. I just reminded myself by traveling from Washington to California that it's really a very big country. And it has tremendous richness, which, you know, I mean, when you don't travel, you may not be so conscious about. It's a great country. It has done a tremendous achievement in world history. But right now, I can assure you, that is not the image of people have of the United States around the world. Because the legacy of 3 Bush administrations and more than 1 Obama administration has blurred the image of the United States. And people forget about the great tradition of the United States. So let's have a solemn oath to restore the great America, to rebuild the United States after all of these years of destruction since the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The United States must go back to what it used to be with the founding fathers, with Alexander Hamilton, John Quincy Adams, Lincoln, FDR, Martin Luther King, and John F. Kennedy. It must become again for the whole world a beacon of hope and a temple of liberty. It must be what the aspiration of the founding fathers was, that it becomes the place where all the Republican forces of the whole world want to go. It must be again what it was under Franklin D. Roosevelt, a liberator of the world against fascism. It must be again the image of hope as it was represented by John F. Kennedy and the moon landing, which created a whole generation of optimistic children who thought everything was possible if you apply science and technology. We must have again the cultural optimism associated with the idea that mankind is capable of exploring and colonizing outer space, and that by realizing another John F. Kennedy's great project, NAVAPA, that we can, you know, continue the civilization and colonization of the West, which stopped somewhere with Teddy Roosevelt, and which already Abraham Lincoln had, you know, said that infrastructure development is deepening the society through modernization and urbanization instead of a simple horizontal expansion. And therefore, we have to have great infrastructure projects in the tradition of the TVA as a stepping stone to the realization of the world land bridge and the reconstruction of the world economy. But the most hopeful momentum which we see right now to go in the direction of the second option I mentioned is the fight for the reinstitution of the Glass-Steagall Act in the United States, which is the absolute indispensable first step. Because we face the danger of a new fascism, and that only if we turn basically back to this Glass-Steagall tradition do we have a chance. Now, Glass-Steagall is one of these things which the United States own. And all the Europeans are telling us, well, that's an American thing. We don't have that tradition. We have universal banking, which is not quite true. But I think Glass-Steagall is an American property in the same way like the American Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, to which all great minds and presidents have always turned back. In the same way, like, you know, Lincoln went back to the Declaration of Independence. So did Martin Luther King. And so we have to revive Glass-Steagall today, because that was the dividing line when in the 30s Europe went in the direction of fascism, and Franklin D. Roosevelt ended the danger of fascism by applying Glass-Steagall and going for the separation of the banks. He added the Pecora Commission, putting these bankers in front of hearings, and most of them, or many of them, were put to jail, which he described so inspiring in Wall Street Under Oath, the booklet he wrote about that. Now, the US population, contrary to the Europeans, has in their memory, in their sort of collective genetic memory that with the policy of Glass-Steagall, you can bring the country out of the depression. And if you look at the long process of undoing the FDR measures, which unfortunately started immediately with Truman, who allied with Churchill and really was a traitor to the legacy of Franklin D. Roosevelt, who had defeated fascism, that was then followed by Nixon, who repealed the Bretton Woods system in 71, which as a prophetic prognosis was recognized by my husband, Lyndon LaRouche, that it would lead to a situation where the world would be faced either with the danger of a new depression and fascism or a new world order in the direction of a new world order. Then the next step of this repealing of the FDR legacy was what the Trilateral Commission did in 1976 with their policy of controlled disintegration of the world economy, which is the reason why the hopeful development of many third world countries was interrupted. Never again a Japan was the slogan of these people. Japan meaning to turn a country, a feudal country within years, into a highly industrial country on the basis of the method of the American system. Then in 1984, you had Alan Greenspan, who worked at that time for J.P. Morgan, already plotting to undo Glass-Steagall, together with Mr. Dudley, who is presently the head of the New York Fed. Then in 1987, when Alan Greenspan became the chief of the Federal Reserve, he started to undermine Glass-Steagall by giving more powers to the banks to speculate. Then in 1999, the repeal of Glass-Steagall occurred. And since that time, you have an orgy of deregulation in the United States and in Europe. And a casino economy developed worldwide. Step by step, out of the financial system, a monster developed. Now that formulation, monster, is not from me, but it comes from Wolfgang Köhler, who is the former president of Germany, and he was the head of the IMF at one point. And we are dealing with a monster. John Perkins, who wrote the autobiographical work, The Economic Hitman, described with what method this system is operating towards the third world. And if you look at the long list of crimes, which the banking system since a long time has engaged in, you see that they long ago have stopped to be the servant of industry, which is what a banking system should be, and they are not working in the interest of the general welfare as it is demanded in the preamble of the Constitution, but they have cheated their customers again and again. The LIBOR scandal, which went on for decades, has cheated their customers in the three-digit billions. The too big to fail banks, the so-called GC fees, generally globally systemically relevant banks. They have swindled their customers by selling worthless papers like Goldman Sachs and many others. They have cheated the figures to enter Greece into the EU like Goldman Sachs, Hongsheng Banking Corporation. They have laundered the Mexican drug money 85% and made 80 billion profit. And then they got 1.9 billion fine, and they calculated that already in the operating cost. Nothing but a slap on the wrist. So Viktor Ivanov, who is the Russian drug czar, together with Antonio Maria Costa, who was the UN drug czar, both made repeatedly the point that the entire banking system would have long gone bankrupt, but for the influx of money laundering from the international drug trade. I could go on with that list. I just wanted to identify what we are dealing with, that we are not dealing with bankers and banking system, which is sort of, you know, legitimate or nice, but you are dealing with systemic system which has become systemically criminal. The Madoff scandal, the former head of the New York Fed, New York Exchange Bourse, swindled their customers with a Ponzi scheme whereby they lost $50 billion. Now, since the deregulation of the system, I have made repeatedly the point that the entire international financial system is nothing but a big Ponzi scheme. They deliberately create bubbles, appealing to the greed and the profit hunger of the people through gambling. They lure small investors repeatedly into this and then cheat them. And, you know, you have a gigantic system of transfer from the poor to the rich. They create bubbles, the new economy bubble, the so-called dot-com bubble, which popped in March 2000, where only 16 trillion were wiped out and a lot of people were cheated. Then the secondary mortgage bubble in July, which popped in July 2007, and where again, prophetically, my husband had warned 1 week earlier that this would happen, and all we would see after that would be the disintegration of the world financial system, and he was absolutely on the mark. Now, on the 15th of September in 2008, when Lehman Brothers collapsed, this for a very short period sent a shockwave around the world. And they invented the so-called bailout instrument, which was essentially a way of transforming private gambling debt into public state debt and made the taxpayer pay. That was combined with brutal austerity in Europe through the Troika, the IMF, the EZB, and the EU Commission. And that destroyed about up to 30% of the real economy in Greece, Spain, Italy, Portugal, and ruined health systems. It increased the suicide rate. In 1 year alone in Greece, more than 1,000 people committed suicide out of desperation, and these were figures from 2010. In Greece, you have today 64.2% youth unemployment, 60% in Spain. These countries are being turned into third world countries. This has been named by the United Nations a human rights violation. Manuel Alegre has said what the EU policy is doing to all of Europe right now is turning it into a concentration camp where those who are not yet going to the slaughter bank should not rejoice because they will be the next. So it is a big mistake to think that all of this does not affect you. Because in the United States, you already have pockets like Greece. Look at Detroit. Detroit used to be the fourth largest city. It had the highest per capita income in the 60s. And since 1960, it lost 63% of its population. 40% of the street lights don't function. 60% of the children are living in poverty. Less than 50% of the people living there work. 47% of the population in Greece is functionally illiterate. The murder rate is 11 times higher than in New York, and only 10% of the crimes are being solved because the police force has been cut back so much. Now, the bailout instrument, which has been used for 5 years and somewhere between 24 to 30 trillion of money has been pumped in to keep this afloat, has come to a certain end because you are looking at the potential of an immediate hyperinflation. So Bernanke announced that he would slow down quantitative easing, which immediately led to an extreme volatility in the markets. The emerging market figures collapsed, and you know, basically, you know, the markets reacted with extreme nervosity. Now, if you look at the permanent bailout fund, which has been created in Europe, the ESM, there are only a ridiculous 500 billion euro in it. And the Financial Times just had a column by Münchau where he said that, you know, this is ridiculous because this bailout fund is standing against 2.5 trillion of probable bad debt of European banks alone. So the European crisis is fully coming back. Italy will soon need a new package, Spain, Portugal, Greece, Cyprus, and then the next big one will be France. So therefore, you know, this cannot be done with normal means. So when recently JP Morgan published a research paper with the title Adjustment in the Euro Era, Eurozone, Euro Era, halfway there, meaning halfway a banking dictatorship has already been established, no national sovereignty anymore, but that the obstacle is still the so-called political obstacle, a legacy of countries of the southern periphery, meaning Greece, Italy, Spain, and so forth, that they still have constitutions which were made in the post-war period and therefore have anti-fascist guidelines in them. So that has to be broken, and therefore because the political systems of these countries have typical such features like weak executives, weak central states relative to the regimes, constitutional protection of labor rights, consensus-building systems which foster political consensus, and the might of the right to protest if unwelcome changes are made to the political status quo, meaning the right to demonstrate against unjust policies. The shortcomings of these political legacies has been revealed by the crisis. Countries around the periphery have only been partially successful in producing fiscal and economic reform agendas with governments constrained by constitutions like Portugal, powerful regions like Spain, and the rise of populist parties like Italy and Greece. Now, this is unbelievable. If you eliminate the bankers' talk from what they are writing here, what they are saying is when people are demonstrating to keep their job, that has to go. Trade union rights have to go. Human rights have to go. Democracy has to go. And I can assure you, much of this has already been eliminated in Europe. Now, the BIS, the Bank of International Settlement, at their annual meeting on the 23rd of June this month, basically went even a step further and said quantitative easing has to stop. Instead, there should be brutal austerity combined with the bail-in policy. Now, the bail-in instrument has been worked on since 2009 by the Financial Stability Board, which is located in the building of the BIS in Basel. And the line with which this is sold is to say, oh, no longer should we have bailout packages, the taxpayer should no longer pay, but the banks themselves, the stockholders, the rich people, they should now pay. Now that's obviously a whole bunch of baloney, because if you look what the bail-in does, the so-called Cyprus template, they, at a certain point, when it was clear that Cyprus was reaching a point of insolvency, they made a haircut of 60% to the two largest banks. And in the 3 months since that happened, the real economy of Cyprus has shrunk by 70%. This country is flat, bankruptcies, unemployment. Already now, there was a reduction of the life expectancy from 80 to 75%. And, you know, this is just ending Cyprus. And Cyprus, under the present regime, has no chance to come back. So the EU Commission which worked on, together with the Financial Stability Board, worked on the legislation for the bail-in, admits that this law was written by the ISDA, the International Swap and Derivative Association. And if you look up what that is, it is made up of the 28 too-big-to-fail banks. So they write a law that, you know, basically the politicians are supposed to carry out. And the bail-in simply means that, you know, there will be a hierarchy of creditors who will have to pay, but derivatives are exempt because, as they write in their explanation, people, some people are mistaken by thinking that derivatives are a normal form of capital and therefore think, for reasons of fairness, they should also have a haircut, but this is not so, therefore the derivatives should be exempt. And then the bondholders, the shareholders, the people who have deposits should be all asked to contribute. Now, the EU finance ministers this week agreed on this legislation of the EU Commission, and this will now go to the European Parliament to be voted on until the end of the year. So this is supposed to be the first step in the direction of a banking union where the European Central Bank would be the bank supervision, and then the European Stability Mechanism would be put together with the Cross-Border Resolution Authority in one institution. Now that means that the German savings banks would have to pay and therefore the people who have little deposits in these banks pay if, for example, a big French bank goes belly up. And that will happen fairly soon, as we absolutely are certain of. Now, the Belgian magazine Express just reported that the EU finance minister meeting, which took place this week, based itself on a paper from the Boston Consulting Group, BCG, which is the second largest management consultancy, and a paper they wrote in 2011, which is basically a game plan of wiping out large chunks of the financial assets at a stroke. They basically say the financial system is so over-indebted that you have to have a drastic haircut, 34% across the board in Europe, 26% in the United States, 27% in the UK, 47% in Greece, 56% in Spain, 57% in Portugal. Now, if you do that in the highly industrialized parts of Europe, in the same way like the agricultural regions, you are on the spot killing people on a mass base. Because this goes along with cuts in healthcare, cuts in pensions, and destruction of the real economy. So then they say in this paper from the Boston Consulting Group, there would have to be a clear commitment by the European governments to address the pressing issue of age-related spending increases. Now, what that means is that, as you know, you have a demographic development in Germany, for example, where a lot of people are now above pension age, and you have a very slow birth rate, and therefore, you know, there is a certain problem which you could easily solve. If you had 3% of economic growth, you could solve this problem without a problem. But if you have zero growth or negative growth, as we have it now, naturally, these people, they think instead of a Nazi-style euthanasia by wiping out pensions, social security, raising the retirement age, which for some people may function because they want to work, but some people who have worked very hard, who have creaky bones when they get into pension age, it is shortening their life, and that is intentioned. So this measure of this sudden haircut would cause a deleveraging and basically would risk social unrest, they say. Now, it would cause a social explosion. Now, Schäuble, the German finance minister, at this recent meeting, proposed an 8% across cut, which was rejected. But the BCG says only 30% and more will be a way out of this crisis. Now, this is totally insane because it would lead to mass deaths in Europe and in the United States. And it would not address the fundamental problem, namely the 1.4 quadrillion outstanding derivative contracts, which according to the ISDA are to be exempt from the haircut. It would kill the people and keeps the virtual assets of the speculators. Now, top EU Commission officials recently discussed in a private circle, and we have learned that from extremely reliable people who participated in these discussions, it's too bad, we have to reduce the life expectancy to 66 years. We can't pay these pensions. Now, also, it is discussed in Europe at this point that the national budgets this year will have to pay an additional 100 billion or so into this European fund, which is supposed to be created. Now, the bail-in policy would wipe out everything that is good. The real economy, wages, pensions, social systems, and it would keep the worthless speculative area alive. Therefore, we absolutely have to go on the war path and say, no more bailout and no more bail-in. We have to stop the robbery against the part of the economy which is still productive, and we have to, which enhances the waste system. This is why LaRouche has basically proposed recently that the United States has to basically call in all European, all debt of all those unpayable debt from the big London and European banks. And that has to be done preemptively before this bail-in policy sets in. It has to be done now. It would be the equivalent of an immediate margin call to that debt, and then the utter bankruptcy of these banks and their US counterparts will be obvious. Obviously, it has to be followed instantly with the implementation of Glass-Steagall by the US Congress, and something like a resolution trust corporation could be created, which was used in the savings and loans crisis. Glass-Steagall would then separate the banks. You would put the commercial banks under state protection, and the investment banks will have to take care of themselves without taxpayer money, without bailouts, and if their books then reveal that they are in the red, too bad, then they have to declare insolvency. So then, naturally, it has to be followed by a credit system which immediately restores growth, creates productive full employment, and, you know, as we all have worked on for quite some while and we hear more about, NAVAPA has to be the immediate driver of the US economy, creating 6 million jobs as only the beginning. But let's look briefly at the history of what we are dealing with. Because the BIS, EU Commission, JP Morgan bail-in scheme is de facto a repeat of what the Versailles Treaty did towards Germany after the First World War. Only this time they want to apply a Versailles Treaty on the whole world. At the end of World War I, the Allies came up with the verdict that Germany was the sole guilty party of World War I, which no honest historian today is claiming anymore, and it is completely absurd if you consider the British role in the geopolitical manipulation of the chessboard, which started with the ouster of Bismarck as a chancellor after Bismarck had transformed Germany from a feudal state into a highly industrialized nation based on the American system of economy, because Bismarck completely changed after he learned the theories of Henry C. Carey and started to reject free trade and established protectionism instead. Now, out of this came the building of the Trans-Siberian Railroad between Germany and Russia and other parts of Europe, and that was why then the British came up with the theory of geopolitics, Mackinder, Milner, and Haushofer, basically saying whoever controls the Eurasian heartland will control the planet. And this puts at a disadvantage the Atlantic Rim countries. Now, the British role in preparing the stage for World War I is well documented, and you can find it in our publications. Now, the Versailles Treaty basically put the entire war preparation cost on Germany, which at that point was 169 billion gold mark. This was 295% of the German BIP, domestic, gross domestic product, which if you apply that for US figures for 2012, where the gross domestic product is 15 trillion, it would be the equivalent of 4,425 trillion the US would have to pay, or 4.425 quadrillion over three generations. Now, these payments were demanded by France, Britain, Belgium, and Italy, who in turn owed them to the City of London and Wall Street. And basically, one of the banks who mediated that was J.P. Morgan Jr., John Piemont Morgan Jr. And basically, according to the statement of the bank itself, they played a significant role in the financial victory for the Allies. For example, in September 1915, they financed an Anglo-French loan of $500 million, which was the largest loan Wall Street at that time ever gave. And it was used to buy weapons, because J.P. Morgan was also the U.S. commissioner for this period. Now, there was no way how the German economy could pay this. So it is known the Reichsmark started to print money. And by the spring 23, when the French Prime Minister Poincaré and the Belgian King said, we want more payments, and the Germans couldn't pay, they occupied the Rhineland, cost to confiscate the coal directly. And then between spring 23 and November, the hyperinflation exploded. And the whole thing came to a standstill, where people at the end were bringing Reichsmark in wheelbarrows until 12 o'clock, because at 12 o'clock the next inflation rate was fixed and the money was nothing worth anymore. So at that point, the Allies designed 10 banks from five countries under the leadership of Charles Dawes, a banker selected by J.P. Morgan, aided by Owen Young, another J.P. Morgan banker. And in 1924, the Dawes Plan was signed in London. It included reform that the French and Belgian troops were withdrawn, a reduction in the yearly payments, a reform of the Reichsbank, and the Allies decided to put in the Reichsbank as a director, Hjalmar Schacht, who was a board member of Dresdner Bank and the founder of the German Democratic Party. Now, Hjalmar Schacht worked closely with J.P. Morgan, and they issued 800 billion Reichsmark bond, sponsored supposedly for industrial and infrastructure development to enable Germany to pay back more of these reparations. In reality, that money went largely into a network of financial firms which were allied with J.P. Morgan, IG Farben, and others, who became the financiers of Hitler. In 1928, it was clear that Germany could not pay these exorbitant sums, and they decided a new bailout plan, the so-called Young Plan, which again was a Morgan banker. Now, the negotiations to implement that started in February 29 between Schacht, J.P. Morgan, who was the U.S. negotiator, but then came the big Wall Street crash in October 29, and nobody could give any credits anymore to anybody. And at that point, Germany was put under an extreme austerity regime by Chancellor Brüning, which caused to produce between 1929 and 32 from 1.5 million unemployed to 6 million unemployed. Without Hitler, would not have been able to take power. And naturally, Hitler was financed by some bankers from London and New York, Montague Norman, Averill Harriman, Prescott Bush. There was a big affinity between the American Eugenics Society, who worked with the Nazis already in the 20s because they liked his race policy. Now, the circles who were involved in the coup attempt against Franklin D. Roosevelt, who tried to convince General Major Smedley Butler to make a coup against Roosevelt, which did not function because he revealed it to the US Congress and the media. So this is what we are dealing with. And obviously, by their own admission, these people, like the Boston Group and others, have put themselves in that tradition by referring to the 30s. Now, the lesson to be learned from all of this is that the combination of the debt tyranny and Schachtian economics breeds fascism. When the BCG says programs we describe would be traumatic and they would not be popular, the longer politicians wait before they implement it, the more necessary they will become. Unfortunately, reaching a consensus is a tough question and might require an environment last seen in the 30s. Now, that is the policy which the EU finance ministers just agreed on with their bail-in policy. It's open fascism. In 1971, Lynn LaRouche debated Abba Lerner in a famous debate in Columbus University in New York. And he got Abba Lerner at that point to admit, he said, if people would have accepted Hjalmar Schacht, we would not have needed Hitler. Now, the EU finance ministers just accepted Schacht. Now, the transatlantic world is in a debt trap like the Versailles Treaty. The quadrillions Germany had to pay are the equivalent of the quadrillions of outstanding derivatives, which are presently about 1.4 trillion. And even if you reduce that by half, because this is the amount which goes to the counterparts in the derivative contracts, it still would leave a sum between 700 and 800 trillion, as compared to a meager 500 billion in the European Stability Mechanism. Now, the Versailles bail-in policy basically puts the world hostage to the past. And as you know, that has led to World War II, hyperinflation, the Great Depression. Today, I can assure you, if we don't change that, it will lead to World War III, but much faster. Because if you look at the situation in Syria and Iran, which is already a complete powder keg, and one more step, and this will go into an escalation without stopping it. There was recently a paper written by the official paper of the US Air Force, which said blatantly that the previous NATO strategy of mutual assured destruction is no longer valid, meaning that you cannot use thermonuclear weapons, because if you do, then everybody eliminates each other and there is nothing left. Because they argue that now new technologies have developed and allow to take out the nuclear arsenal of your opponent without nuclear fallout. Now, that is going from MAD to sheer madness. Now, the Glass-Steagall policy and what FDR did has shown the way how we can get out of the depression. Lynn, in the webcast last evening, which you should absolutely all look at, called for a national campaign for what is the real Glass-Steagall, what it really means, what are the principles of a credit system, what is the image of man associated with it. And I think we have to be committed for a holy mission in the United States to adopt Glass-Steagall, because the United States can do it. Because you have the precious good of national sovereignty, even if it's in danger. But you have the preamble of the Constitution, you have the Declaration of Independence, and this is a very, very precious good. Because if you look at the evolution of the sovereign nation state, it was combined with enormous struggles. It's not something which evidently was there. Because in the Middle Ages, you had imperial structures. The papacy and the emperors would be a universal system, and you did not have states. So it took enormous struggles to come to the first sovereign states, which were implemented in England by Henry II, the Plantagenet, and in France by Louis the 11th, and in Sicily by Frederick II of Hohenstaufen. But it took Nicholas of Cusa and his very important writing, groundbreaking writing of the Concordantia Catholica, where for the first time the representative system was elaborated, including the idea of the equality of all human beings in front of the law. Defining that government has legitimacy only with the consensus of the governed. Now, this obviously is a highly actual question in the light of the recent NSA developments, because there is no consent of the governed. And I think that that has to be invoked again. Now, Nicolaus basically said that this consent of the governed to be ruled is a human rights not only for Germany, but for all people in the world. He said, even in far places away like Ethiopia, people should have the same right. So he defined it as a universal principle. Now, he also said that all legitimate authority results out of the chosen concordance and the voluntary submission of the governed. Because of the fact that all human beings are endowed with equal natural rights, there is a divine seed, so that all authority which comes from God as man himself is regarded as divine if it results out of the consensus of the governed. Now, therefore, a system of equality before the law, the representative system, where the representative has to fight for the rights of the governed and represent the right of the government, is the only way how the inalienable right of all individuals can be protected. Now, this was written by Nicolaus of Cus in 1433, and it took exactly 343 years before it was realized in the US Declaration of Independence and Constitution. Now, in Europe, we have some constitutions which are approximations of this, but never in the forceful way how the American Constitution defines it. Also, we lost all sovereignty already to the EU dictatorship. Therefore, that leaves a very special responsibility to you, to the American people, and to the US Congress, because they are the representatives of exactly this representative system. So let's organize a passionate campaign to say what we used to say in 1945, never again. I appeal to you, the American people, to once again save the world from fascism. We have a world drama, but it does not take place on a stage. It's real history. And we, our organization, are the main actors. So let's make sure it does not end as a tragedy, but that it is the beginning of a new paradigm of a second American revolution and a new renaissance for all of mankind.